Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, we're spending the hour discussing an incredible investigation about how between 1946 and 1963, lab scientists knowingly exposed at least 1,073 servicemen, dock workers, lab employees, and others to potentially harmful radiation through war games, decontamination tests, and medical studies. The multi-part series by San Francisco Public Press, in collaboration with The Guardian, sheds new light on the operations of the U.S. Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory at San Francisco's Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. Now, a review of thousands of pages of government and academic records by the SF Public Press shows that scientists there conducted at least 24 studies exposing humans to radiation over almost 20 years, nearly three times more than a federal inquiry had acknowledged decades later. Researchers reported dozens of safety violations without any apparent repercussions, and there's no evidence that the government tracked the long-term effects on study participants or on residents of this historically African-American neighborhood who have long suspected that their health problems were connected to pollution from the lab. Now, you can read the whole series at kalw.org, where we've posted a link. And today, we are joined by Chris Roberts, the lead reporter of the Exposed series. He is an award-winning investigative reporter with almost 20 years of experience in digital and print media. And Chris won an investigative reporting award for a Curbed SF series on the Hunters Point Shipyard environmental fraud scandal. And there's also a series, a two-part podcast series produced by Rebecca Bow that we have posted on that on our website as well. So, Chris, it's so good to have you with us, and congratulations on this very important series.
Thank you, Ethan. And good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, it's wonderful that we have you for this hour to discuss this reporting that you've done, this multi-part investigation. So I know that the San Francisco Public Press sifted through thousands of pages of what must have been obscure records, interviewed experts, tracked down elderly veterans who are subject to some of these ethically questionable radiation exposures. Can you just tell us, how did this massive investigation that you did come about in the first place?
Sure. As you mentioned, the Hunters Point redevelopment project has been in the news, less so now maybe, but in 2018, the biggest real estate redevelopment project in San Francisco for a century was, pick your metaphor, thrown into disarray, paused because of a fraud testing scandal. And we can get into that later. But that raised a lot of questions about why this part of the city is so dirty. What exactly happened there? 20 years ago, Lisa Davis from SF Weekly did what was at the time by far the deepest investigation into exactly what happened at the Hunters Point shipyard, what the Navy did at its atomic research facility. But we kind of wanted to follow up on that, but we wanted to have sort of a narrow focus on the human toll of the research slate at the shipyard. And so the public press's executive director, Michael Stoll, he had some old lab reports that he dug up, I think around the same time, that just indicated that, there were some scientists there and they were doing some work, and the subjects of the experiments that the scientists were working on did receive a dose of radiation. And so we wanted to see exactly how big the research slate was, and we wanted to see exactly how big the human cost of this research slate was as well.
And Chris, how did you access the documents? Were any of these classified? How did you find them? How were you able to review them?
So there are definitely a lot of documents related to the shipyard that are still classified. And oddly enough, some of these documents are being reclassified. If you go to one of the sources was the National Archive in San Bruno, not too far away from where the shipyard was. And if you go there, I mean, there's, I think I'm probably going to get the figure wrong, but there's like something like 650 linear feet of records there, which basically means, you know, tens of thousands of pages of pieces of paper that are in all kinds of different conditions. That means, you know, this is, I'm going to date myself, but I don't know if any of us remember carbon copies. Some of them are faded carbon copies. Some of them are like copies of copies. You know, it is kind of a mess. But if you go there, you'll open up a folder and you'll get like a sheet of paper that says, yeah, this has been reclassified and sent back to Washington. So yeah, like a bunch of stuff. I guess that's one point to make, is that the findings that we make in this series, these are sort of minimum numbers, real numbers in terms of how many studies, how many people exposed, things of this nature. This is just the minimum number that we were certain of. So the real number is definitely higher. But then, so right, so there's a bunch of stuff in the National Archives in San Bruno. And then from there, the pandemic kind of worked in our favor. We've been working on this for a while. This is sort of like my pandemic baby. You know, some people learn how to bake bread and, you know, brew beer. And I spent a lot of time in reading documents from 80 years, you know, from 50, 60, 70 years ago. A lot of universities that have some of these records and some other archives as well kind of made things a little bit easier during the pandemic, you know, because obviously there's no public access. And so we were able to get scans from the National Testing the National Nuclear Testing Archive in Las Vegas. The archivists there know me very well. They're very kind. University archives, you know, the occasional report. One thing that's important to note is that when the lab closed in 1969, most of its library was literally, most of its library, as well as some pretty expensive equipment, was literally thrown in the trash. You know, we found oral histories of some of the researchers there who said that a decade later, they couldn't find copies of their own work. You know, and that was within a decade of the lab closing. You know, now we're 55 years later. So it was a combination, Ethan, of the National Archives, the Department of Energy's archives, which are, some of them are in Las Vegas, some of them are in DC. We filed public we filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the Navy, with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So yeah, I mean, literally we found documentation scattered all across the US. And again, I want to emphasize, this is at best just a partial record.
Well, it's really an amazing deep dive, and I think a wonderful use of your COVID time and a real contribution. Yeah. I would just point out to listeners, this is a six-part series along with the two-part podcast. So there's a lot of information. I mean, this is almost dissertation level of research that you put in here. And I just have to ask quickly, because you mentioned that some of these documents are now being reclassified, yeah, and therefore presumably not able to be accessed by researchers, journalists like yourself. I mean, what do you make of that? Is there, it almost feels like the whiff of a cover up here. I mean, is there any stated reason why they're reclassifying documents that weren't previously classified?
Yeah, I mean, there is a stated reason. Usually, you know, there's sort of like a blanket, there's sort of like a blanket exemption, or sorry, yeah, like a blanket purpose, reason given. I don't know if you can say it's a cover up. I think that when I talk to, you know, people who have done dissertations on this type of stuff, who do this stuff for a living, the assumption is kind of that it's something that describes what can be considered a national security secret, which is usually related to the effects of weapons. Now, why would the government want to keep secret studies or data or descriptions of weapons effects related to weapons that haven't been in the arsenal for decades? I think that, I guess, just sort of, I'm not trying to make excuses, but just sort of putting myself in the shoes of someone at the government, they don't really stand to benefit by giving too much access. And they'll be punished, I think, if there's too much access. So I think that they sort of err on the side of keeping things secret. But the other thing that I kind of want to emphasize is that a lot of what this lab did back in the 50s and 60s, sort of its heyday, was done in the public eye, these research projects that they did, you know, spreading radioactive fallout over a field site they had in Contra Costa County, that was in the news. The opening of the lab, the main lab building, which you can still see if you drive up 101 from Bayshore Freeway, and if you look right towards the bay, you can see the building. When it opened, that was front page news in the San Francisco Examiner. So kind of one of the other ironies of this is, even though we've sort of forgotten about this stuff, it slipped from the public memory, it was absolutely done in the light of day during the Cold War. A lot of these, they're hard to find now, but a lot of these reports and scientific articles, you know, published in journals and whatnot, yeah, these are all published in the 50s and 60s, you know, maybe not widely circulated, but again, yeah, like a lot of this stuff was done in the full light of day.
So Chris, there's so much in the series that we're not going to be able to get into, but let's talk about the U.S. Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory, as we've talked about, based at San Francisco's Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. And let's just talk about what happened there, because your analysis talks about how over 20 years, there were at least 24 experiments that exposed humans to radiation. Can you just talk about more about the genesis of this lab and why the military decided to build a radiation lab right here in San Francisco in the Bay Area?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And I guess the quickest answer is that it was sort of an accident of geography. The U.S. Navy at the end of World War II was sort of faced with an existential crisis after the nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Nuclear war, I mean, I'm not a military expert, but I know enough to say that, yeah, it triggered an absolute revolution in what war is, how to fight it, things like this. And the Navy was already kind of undergoing that existential crisis due to the advent of, you know, air power and submarines. And in a sort of a desperate-ish effort to demonstrate that, yeah, you can still fight war from, you know, floating gun batteries, you know, which is what a battleship is. Some people that, you know, the public now may know their names thanks to the Oppenheimer movie, pressured the Navy, which then pressured the Truman administration to do a demonstration, to do the first post-war weapons tests at Bikini Atoll in 1946. Those tests did not go well. There was two bombs. One was dropped from a plane, completely missed the targets, which were a bunch of old battleships anchored in a lagoon. And the second one detonated underwater, didn't destroy the ships, but kind of wrecked them, just made them all twisted and then made them highly radioactive as well. That also created a big radioactive wave that then rolled over some of the support fleet. And so the Navy was left with sort of two things. They realized that, yeah, we really can't fight a nuclear war. It's not going to work for us. But now we have this fleet of radioactive ships. What do we do with them? And the decision was made to study them because, in part, if the Navy studied them, they would then have the upper hand over other branches of the military in staying relevant and staying relevant and continuing to get money from the Pentagon in a nuclear war scenario. And the accident of geography was, you know, if you're in the South Pacific and you're asking yourself, okay, where do we take these things? What's the closest place we could go where we could research them? And the answer was the Natural Harbor in San Francisco Bay. There was a major shipyard in Hunters Point. It was an old dry dock that the Navy took over at the start of World War II. And conveniently enough, it was really close to some of the at that time and still, the world's foremost research facilities for nuclear physics and things like this. UC Berkeley's very close, Stanford's very close, and that is the short-ish answer of why the Navy chose to tow dozens of radioactive ships to what was then becoming a majority black enclave in a densely populated city. I mean, it's not something that you'd it sounds crazy now. There's a little bit of sense at the time, but yeah, I don't think it's anything that anyone would consider doing now.
It's an amazing confluence of events that led to all this happening right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'd want to let listeners know, if you're just joining us, this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're talking about the deliberate exposure to radiation on a number of human beings, at least 1,073 people who were working at Hunters Point Shipyard, with questions about the radioactive impacts today in that neighborhood. And we're joined by Chris Roberts, lead reporter of the series that talks about this whole incident in the Cold War history. It's called Exposed: The Human Radiation Experiments at Hunters Point, available by SF Public Press, and it's available on our website at klw.org. Well, Chris, you talked about how the laboratory ended up here in the Bay Area. Can you just give us a sense of what this Navy facility looked like? I know that there's a map that you have as part of the series, but can you just kind of describe this for listeners?
Yeah, I mean, well, the whole shipyard, if you look at a map of San Francisco and the southeastern corner, there's sort of like a fist shape. This is a metaphor I always use, sort of jutting out into the bay. And again, I think folks know it. There's a massive gantry crane that you can see from the East Bay, and you can see it from 101. At one time, it was the largest gantry crane in the world. That is on the edge of the shipyard. But then a little bit further in from there, sort of nestled up against a hillside, is a six-story building. It doesn't really appear to have any windows, sort of like white concrete, really stark on the right day. It really, really, sort of like jumps out at you if you know what you're looking for. And that is the headquarters of the U.S. Naval Radiological Defense Lab. There were other buildings that they used on the shipyard for the lab. There's an animal colony that UCSF uses right now. And that was an old Navy building where the Navy kept some of the lab animals, mice and other mammals that it used in experiments to determine, how much radiation would likely kill somebody. And they also had a field facility called Camp Parks. I think that one's in Alameda County. And there was a second one. There was a second old Army camp called Camp Stoneman. That was in Contra Costa County, where they did, at both of those places, they did a bunch of field exercises. But they also did field exercises off the coast of San Clemente Island near San Diego. They detonated radioactive bombs there to see how radioactivity might disperse in water. And there were talk of doing exercises elsewhere. They talked about setting off bombs. I'm not kidding about this. They talked about setting off, not a nuclear weapon per se, but I guess you could say maybe like a dirty bomb in Mono Lake. Lab scientists worked in the South Pacific when the hydrogen bomb tests in the mid-1950s accidentally contaminated some of the Marshallese Islanders. And lab scientists also worked in Nevada at the U.S.'s main area for atmospheric tests too. So, to say that it was a San Francisco lab, but yeah, as we sort of demonstrate here, I mean, it had a sprawling footprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some pretty horrific ideas that they were bandying about. Well, you've talked about how scientists were involved in this. Who else worked there at the lab? Can you describe the people you would see walking around?
Yeah, I mean, at its peak, there were hundreds and hundreds of people worked there. And it ranged from, PhDs, physicists, physicians. I mean, some real, real, people talk about like best and brightest. But also, there were blue collar workers. There were people from the neighborhood who would, whether you're sweeping the floors or, emptying the animal cages, stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, it really was an absolute cross section of, Stanford and Berkeley PhDs, but, folks who might have lived right off Third Street as well, which I think is a reflection of how big of a facility broadly the shipyard was. At its peak, You know, fewer people worked there when it closed in 1974. But maybe we can just talk about that for a minute. I mean, it was a major employer. It is one of the reasons why Bayview Hunters Point became majority African American. Folks, you know, as part of the Great Migration, part of the wartime economy, you know, it's something we don't think about a lot living in the Bay Area, how important the military industrial complex was to, you know, why Oakland is black, you know, why there are, you know, smart people working at Lawrence Berkeley and Lawrence Livermore National Labs. But yeah, so in that way, it really was like a cross-section of the entire Bay Area.
And the people who are working there, they were exposed to radiation in multiple ways, just simply by working there. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. And people who would work there, you know, or even visitors, you know, you'd put a little badge of film on like your lapel or whatever, and the film was supposed to change color depending on how much radiation you would absorb. Not everyone would get a dose, and sometimes you get a dose that was pretty small. I think that's one thing that we want to emphasize, is that a lot of these doses were relatively small. You might get the same amount on a cross-country flight. You know, that's at least what something that the, you can call them apologists maybe, but, you know, people who are sort of arguing that this was expedient, that this was the right thing to do. But then there are really, some of the stories kind of sound crazy now. I mean, the way that people would casually get exposed, like one of the ones that really sticks out in my mind is, and not to get too technical here, but there is, trying to think of the best way to put this. All right, so everyone in the country gets, you know, a certain amount of radiation exposure per year. Some of it is from naturally occurring stuff. Some of it is still remnants of above ground nuclear testing. But someone got, I think, roughly 8 times the dose that you or I would get on an annual basis, because they propped open a door with their foot while an experiment was ongoing. Some of the biggest doses that we saw were not subjects of experiments, but workers who, while they were spreading the radioactive synthetic fallout, this is something we can get into later maybe, one of the big experiments was, you know, figuring out how to get how to get radioactive fallout off of a roof, off of a lawn, which is something that everyone would have to deal with if there was ever nuclear war. Some of the workers spreading the stuff when they're trying to fix like a broken nozzle, they got a huge dose. The lab had a hot cell where they were creating this synthetic fallout. The biggest dose we ever saw, which is more than the annual allotment for a nuclear worker today, you're allowed to get 5 REM. REM is the unit of measurement here. Someone got, I think, almost double that back in the 60s, trying to enter this hot cell that was malfunctioning. So, yeah, it's interesting to see, I think, how it wasn't even really like the medical subjects per se that we saw who got the biggest dose. It was workers.
Unbelievable. Just the amount of radioactivity going on and how people were so unaware of what was happening. Well, we certainly have a lot more to discuss. We are joined by Chris Roberts, lead reporter of the Exposed series, talking about the deliberate exposure at Hunters Point Shipyard in San Francisco to radiation of over 1,000 people. You're listening to Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're going to have a lot more to discuss for the rest of this hour, right after this short break. Welcome back to Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. For those of you joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We are podcasting our show, and you can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to our past shows there and sign up for our newsletter so you can find out what's coming up next. If you have any show ideas for us, we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at yourcall@klw.org or call us anytime, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We're in the middle of a really amazing discussion here with Chris Roberts about about the radioactivity, the deliberate exposure to people of radioactivity at San Francisco's Hunter's Point during the height of the Cold War. And we are again joined by Chris Roberts, lead reporter of the Exposed series, an award-winning investigative reporter with almost 20 years of experience in digital and print media. And his series, again, is called Exposed, the Human Radiation Experiments at Hunter's Point. Well, Chris, can you talk a little bit more about the nature of the experiments that were going on at this laboratory?
Yeah, absolutely. The lab's sort of main directive was, it's in the title, it's radiological defense. I think that's important to emphasize where, you know, there's other labs and research facilities in the Bay Area that were working on weapons that were sort of like offensive in nature, and some of those are still in operation today. This lab was tasked with trying to figure out how, if at all, it was possible to defend oneself from an atomic attack. And that meant, you know, there's a term that we're familiar with now, they didn't use then. It was called resiliency. You know, could you make a city? Could you make a military base resilient? What methods and techniques could you use to defend yourself, clean your hands, clean a building, clean a lawn, if atomic attack happened? And so as a result, you have these studies. There's one where, you know, people had radioactive material rubbed on their hands, rubbed on their forearms, and then they experimented various methods of getting it off, and they found that it was actually kind of hard to get off. Similarly, at the field facility in Alameda County at Camp Parks and at Camp Stoneman in Contra Costa County, they put this synthetic nuclear fallout, they called it, but it was still radioactive. That wasn't synthetic. They put it on roofs, and they put it on lawns, and they put it on streets. And then they figured out, and they asked themselves, okay, what's the best way to get a bunch of radioactive fallout off of a street? Do you use a fire hose? Do you use a motorized flusher? Do you sweep it? And yeah, I mean, it almost seems pathetic now. I think that there's an understanding, and they had it then too, that if there was an atomic attack, the idea that you'd have the organizational capacity to get a bunch of people out into the street, to start like sweeping radioactive dust off of the street, off of the driveway, off of the roof, seems kind of crazy. But I guess, you know, one thing I've really tried to do throughout this entire series is sort of put myself in their shoes and ask myself, okay, you know, it's the 1950s. The hydrogen bomb has just debuted. The Soviets are working on destructive weapons too. Do you just give up, or do you sort of, you know, whistle past the graveyard and try and figure out something? And yeah, I like to think that I would do something, even if it sounds futile, and even if decades later it sounds not only futile but kind of like wasteful and abusive too, knowing that you were possibly putting people's health at risk for what was essentially, you know, a fool's errand.
Well, and the experiments that you talk about are pretty amazing. Soldiers were ordered to crawl through fields of radioactive sand and soil. I know they had subjects drink water laced with tritium, an isotope of hydrogen, receive injections of radioactive chromium-51. Can you talk about what the thinking was behind some of these types of experiments?
So those actually, those were using techniques that are familiar today called nuclear medicine. In nuclear medicine, and, you know, a lot of folks who have had to have, you know, some pretty serious health problems diagnosed have used some of the same diagnostic techniques today. I mean, the idea there is you absorb a radioactive isotope of an element that's otherwise pretty abundant in the body. For example, you know, tritium. Tritium can sound scary, and it is when it's a component of a hydrogen bomb. But, you know, tritium is just, hydrogen with an extra atom. And I want to emphasize I was a history major, not a science major. So hopefully I don't butcher anything as I'm talking about it off the top of my head. But yeah, H3, you know, water is H2O. So this is H3.
And the idea there is that if you absorb enough of just enough of a radioactive isotope of an element that's already abundant in the body, then in later scans, problem areas like tumors will literally light up. And in this case, there was a very renowned, very smart Navy researcher who had done a bunch of body composition studies, which is, again, sounds kind of archaic, but at the time it was revolutionary. You could really do a quick, you could do a very quick and accurate analysis of someone's bone density, someone's total body water, their red blood cell count. These are really important diagnostic techniques. And so the idea then, you're using this brand new tool to really help people. And I think that was as well, for at least some people in the early atomic era, you're faced with this awesome, terrifying new weapon, which does have some peaceful applications, even if there is, of course, the consequence of radiation, be it from spent nuclear fuel or with these diagnostic techniques. Although another thing that I think is really important to mention, no one really knew what the consequence would be of relatively low levels of radiation exposure. And even now, it's very hotly debated. There are, anyone can search and find research that says, no amount of radiation exposure is safe. Others will say, actually, we feel it's this level is safe. There's others that will say, maybe it's not safe, but the benefits outweigh the risk. So even today, it's very hotly debated.
Well, and that was part of their motivation, was it not? To try to get a sense, these human guinea pigs, essentially, of what radiation exposure might lead to in terms of health outcomes?
Yeah, and I think that it's also important to mention how rare it was to find these sources of data. And that's why, when the Marshallese Islanders received a big dose of fallout from the first hydrogen bomb test, scientists from this lab in San Francisco rushed out there to start, just start running tests on people, telling them what to eat and like what not to eat. And if anyone got a dose during tests there or in Nevada, they then were sort of enlisted to be, you can call them a guinea pig, absolutely. And the other thing to mention too is that this was happening all over the country at military labs, at academic research, at hospitals. The Bay Area is where at UCS, at, I think Letterman Hospital in the Presidio is where this happened. In the years immediately following World War II, some patients were being injected with plutonium by a doctor named Joseph Hamilton. And Hamilton was sort of an advisor to the San Francisco lab, but did not work there directly. So I guess, the other thing to mention here too is that this happened all over the United States.
And I have an email question, and Vincent in San Francisco asks, what role did scientists at UC Berkeley play in these experiments? I know you mentioned briefly that UC Berkeley was involved.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a prominent UC Berkeley researcher named William Seary. Anyone who uses an iPhone, I guess, is familiar with the name. And he absolutely worked with one of these prominent Navy researchers on some of these tests. And I think we should mention that we have a bunch of documents that indicate the San Francisco 49ers participated in one of these nuclear medicine experiments doing sort of body analysis. And if the letters and later oral histories that we saw are to be believed, and we have no reason to think that they can't be, there was the Donner Lab then. Some of the 49ers went up to Berkeley to, drink some of this tritiated water and get an injection of chromium, and then went down to the Hunter's Point Lab for body analysis. So, again, kind of what I was saying about the San Francisco Lab being part of a nationwide effort, I mean, the reason why the lab was here was because Berkeley was nearby and Stanford was nearby. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Working hand in glove with each other. I mean, you know, just thinking about the community of researchers, you know, people sharing research, working with each other, reading each other's work and things like this. Yeah, Berkeley was absolutely part of the network of atomic research and a big reason why the lab is in San Francisco in the first place.
Yeah, such a local story and amazing to see that bit about the San Francisco 49ers and given their play, the poor play this season, it seems like maybe there's still some effects from that radioactivity.
Maybe Nick Bosa wants to have some. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe it'll help. Who knows? So we're joined by Chris Roberts, lead reporter of the Exposed, the Human Radiation Experiments at Hunter's Point series at SF Public Press. We're talking about how all of this went on right here in the Bay Area at Hunter's Point Shipyard. And we have Art in San Francisco dialing in. Art, welcome to your call.
Thank you so much, Ethan, and congratulations, Mr. Roberts, on this on your great reporting. This is such a longstanding and painful story with a huge trove of, you know, information at the San Bruno Archive. I first just want to comment on how, you know, this has been a frustration and agony for residents of Bayview Hunters Point who feel neglected, you know, harmed, neglected, and want some, you know, answers and some health care, if possible, to, you know, remediate anything that has been done to them. They, you know, it involves all three levels of government over such a long period of time.
Yeah.
So I guess there is a lot that could be said, but one of my questions is, do you believe that the use of artificial intelligence to somehow maybe in a digitized version of the archives in San Bruno could come up with some solutions to protect and remediate residents of Bayview Hunters Point and those who were tested, had radioactive testing done on them? I think there needs to be some justice here, and I think your article and this show will help promote, you know, direction toward that.
Yeah, thank you, Art. Yeah, Chris, please respond.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Well, I think that, well, the question was about AI, but I think that what's important to note is that whether it's AI or any other type of intelligence, the actual impact of the lab on the neighborhood itself has never been fully studied. The remediation of the 450 acres roughly that is the former Navy property, that's what the Department of Defense and the EPA are working on, you know, to prepare it for development. That's the other thing we haven't really talked about much, is that, you know, 12,000-ish, I think, by latest estimate, units of housing are supposed to be at the former shipyard and at Candlestick Point, where Candlestick Park, where the stadium used to be, where the park still is. Those areas, not part of the redevelopment, have never been studied for contamination from the shipyard and lab. I mean, there's been some limited, and I should say never been formally studied by the government, or if they have, that's never been released. You know, generations of activists have been told that the Navy's search for contamination, and it's also the other thing to mention, it's not just radioactive material from the lab and from the shipyard and from the ships hit with the atomic bomb during the post-war tests. I mean, shipbuilding and ship repair is nasty, nasty business. There are heavy metals, there are petroleum byproducts. You know, we found a document that said that, you know, in rainy weather, the shipyard was flushing, I mean, just ungodly amounts of sewage into the bay. So the pollution made by the Navy shipyard at Hunter's Point is just profound. And the full impact on the neighborhood has never really been studied. Like, so the search for a lot of these contaminants ends at the Navy's property line, despite stories from, you know, people who we talked to someone that knew a family on Navy Road right outside the shipyard gates. And they said that, yeah, generations of people there have all had the same type of cancer. And then we find out that the Navy had a particle accelerator that was that could literally beam particles into like the hillside. And did they all go into the hillside where they didn't hurt anybody? Did they go somewhere else? We don't know. We found documents that the Navy knew that on some of these target vessels, bits of unexploded plutonium were literally blowing around in the air. Prior to our work, researchers from UC Santa Cruz, the Committee to Bridge the Gap, they noted that the Navy burned off excess fuel from the target ships at the shipyard. I mean, did it blow towards Third Street? Did it blow towards Dogpatch, towards like Potrero? These are all things that just haven't been looked at. And I want to take a second here to emphasize the work done by Dr. Ahimsa Porter Sumchai. She's a neighborhood native. She has been running a biomonitoring survey. Volunteers from the neighborhood who live or work there have gone in to have their urine analyzed. And according to initial results, there are some elements, including heavy metals and maybe some other radioactive material that are found in the shipyard that are in their bodies and shouldn't be there. So, yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of work to figure out exactly how serious the impact has been, and it hasn't been done yet. And I hope someday it is.
Well, so important that we do more investigative work like what you've done, Chris, so far to date. Thank you, Art, for that question. Want to go back to the phones? We have Greg calling in from Palo Alto. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm not sure you'll be able to answer this question, but I'll just bring it up because you mentioned people, scientists, et cetera, having differences of opinion about exposure to ionizing radiation. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Dr. John Goffman, who worked at UC Berkeley. He was the expert on ionizing radiation and just nuclear medicine. He wrote a tome, and in his tome, he concluded, after about 800 pages of discussing this, that there was no level of radiation exposure that was healthy. Yeah. None.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. Yeah, Chris, thoughts in response to, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Goffman or have other thoughts about the academic findings on this subject.
A little bit, yeah. And that's, I think what's important to mention about radiation exposure broadly, well, a couple things. Lifestyle is, and you know, where you live plays a big role. You know, folks in certain parts of the country know about radon gas. You know, you have to have, you have to monitor the amount of radon gas where you are, depending where you are in the country. And yeah, I mean, I guess the point here to draw is that at this lab, as elsewhere in academia, you had people advocating for more exposure, you had people advocating for less. But I think that, you know, in the context of this lab, we should mention that the scientific director who was there for most of the 1950s, his name was Paul Tompkins. He, in his evolution of thinking, you kind of see a microcosm of the evolution of thinking broadly. When he was a young, physicist at the part of the Manhattan Project, he actually signed on to a letter sent to President Truman asking him not to use the atomic bomb on a Japanese city, you know, to do some sort of demonstration on an unpopulated area or otherwise. And obviously he was ignored. That didn't happen. But then when he is at the lab a decade later, sort of advocating for more and more exposure, thinking that, you know what, like, what if we, there's a letter that we saw where he noted that, yeah, like rats that were exposed to radiation seem to have their brains rewired. They would seemingly sense where radiation was and expose it. And there's a letter that we have from him saying, you know, that's really interesting. What if we did that with humans? Later, he's on the Federal Radiation Council, and he's advocating that, you know, federal exposure limits be raised. You could be exposed to more radiation. And the other thing that I'll say right now is that any kind of health problem related to radiation is kind of almost like the perfect crime. It's extremely hard to say that, oh yeah, this cancer or this hypertension or this whatever is related to radiation exposure and from a specific source. You know,
yeah, you almost have to just be able to document elevated levels across a large population. It's hard with any one particular person. Well, we're just coming up to the close of the show here, Chris, and I wanted to make sure I follow up with you on a couple of the sort of what's happened next type of questions here that all that your reporting has raised. And one of the big questions, what about the workers? Once they found out what happened, what's been the follow-up there? What is the story of some of those workers? I assume some of them are potentially still alive today or their relatives. What follow-up do you know about from the human cost of things?
Well, fortunately, there was very little, if not none. We did find some of the veterans, some of the military service people who participated in some of the tests that the lab conducted, some of the synthetic fallout tests. And they say that, there was, some did eventually achieve atomic veteran status, making them eligible for additional health care from the VA and things like this, but that was related to their exposure at the Nevada test site. It seems that labs simply did not follow up on the health of the workers long term, nor the health of the neighborhood.
So we really don't know what happened. And then what about the Pentagon? What have they had to say about all the evidence that you and others have uncovered here?
Yeah, I mean, they don't deny it. They've said that it is a fact that it is a matter of historic record. But it's been a decade long battle in Washington. Like we were talking earlier about the atomic veterans, it's been a decade long battle for there to be recognition as well as care. And, today the Navy's running into some of the same issues. They've admitted in court documents that the neighborhood doesn't trust them anymore to be forthright about how dangerous the shipyard is, about how efficacious the cleanup is. And I just think, to sort of maybe sum it up, what has happened in Hunter's Point, again, has happened all over the country, but it's a sign of how the Cold War, maybe there wasn't much of a exchange of, wasn't much of a battle with the Russians, but there were lots of casualties. They were all American, and the consequences of the Cold War, we are literally still living with it, and we will be for the rest of our lives.
Well, it's such an important point as part of our closing here, but I have to ask you about the latest on the cleanup. We know the Navy has spent about $1.3 billion to remove all the toxic and radioactive material. So what is the latest? What can you tell residents of Hunter's Point and those who have moved into these areas?
Well, they all know it's still ongoing, and occasionally the Navy will still turn up a radioactive object in an area where it's not supposed to be. And that has less to do with the lab and more to do with the Navy's practice of using radioactive material, radium or sometimes strontium, in dials, gauges, and deck markers and things like this. There are 6,000 pounds of radium-tainted garbage in a landfill that's supposed to be parkland. And there's an absolute tangle of lawsuits still ongoing. Laura Waxman from the San Francisco Chronicle recently reported that the U.S. government and the contractor paid by the Navy to clean the area. Several managers of at which pleaded guilty in court to faking the cleanup. A settlement in that lawsuit may be approaching, or rather, negotiations are ongoing. Mm-hmm. We don't know the terms yet. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to ask this because we just have about a minute left here. Just real quick, what's been the reaction to your investigation? And do you have any plans to follow up on this story? What else is in the works for you?
Yeah, I think that, like I was saying earlier, this is just a starting point. These are all just minimums. Like, we know that there's a lot more there. Yeah, we'd absolutely would like to keep digging into it. And it remains, I think, the biggest real estate story in San Francisco, given how many units of housing are supposed to be built there, the impact on Hunter's Point, on the neighborhood, and on the city at large. So I think that it's just a starting point, really.
Well, Chris Roberts, lead reporter of Expose, the Human Radiation Experiments at Hunter's Point. So much more we could talk about, but I just want to thank you for coming on Your Call and for all your amazing work uncovering this story for readers and for coming on the show and communicating it to listeners today.
All right, thanks so much.
Well, that's our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes and give us a review there. And we're, of course, on social media, and you can email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@klw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.